Living on Earth needs your support to be heard each week. Kindly give what you can today by using the donate link to the left of this page. Thanks.
With me now is Dee Williams, who built her own 84-square-foot tiny home. Dee, you were living in a nice 3-bedroom house in Portland, Oregon, when you decided to pack it all away and build a tiny 84-square-foot house on wheels. Why?
Well, I think a part of it was just wanting to do an experiment on myself. You know, I was just getting ready to turn 40, and maybe it was a midlife crisis. I don't know. There were lots of different reasons. You know, I had taken a trip to Guatemala, and on that trip, you know, it was like a big spanking. You know, I really felt compelled when I came home to take a look at the stuff that I didn't even know I had anymore. You know, it's that stuff that you have shoved in your basement, in your garage, and half of my kitchen pots and pans, and, you know, space in my house that I never really used. And, you know, I had bumped into all of these folks in Guatemala who were just incredibly generous and had absolutely nothing. They were dealing with, you know, significant and severe poverty and a cycle of poverty that wasn't going to be broken anytime soon. So, you know, it was kind of this comparison thing that I was kind of brought home with me. And then also, you know, just kind of taking a look at my world and realizing that, you know, I only have this very short period of time. You know, our mortality is a real thing. And if I did want to shake it up, I needed to do that. And so, you know, I started kind of taking a look about, and I had read an article about a guy who had built a similar house to mine. So I was like, you know, what the heck? Maybe I could do that. And everything would be solved.
So you mentioned that you were turning 40. Mm-hmm. And, of course, at 40, people start to think about health and mortality and maybe right. Starting to lose friends or...
Yeah, I had just had a very dear friend of mine that had struggled with cancer for about 14 months. And in that 14-month period, I was back and forth. He lived in Olympia. And I lived in Portland, and I was on the I-5 slab a lot, driving back and forth to help participate in some of his health care. And he passed away in February of 2004, and I bought a set of plans to build a little house at the end of that month. And, you know, a part of it was Mark's death. I think a bigger part of it was seeing this community outpouring for him and his wife and kids. And, you know, it was like, I wanted to be a part of that community. I was just such beautiful, sweet, kind people. And not that my friends in Portland weren't a kick in the pants and good eggs, but I think I just wanted something a little bit different, and I wanted to get plugged into a community that did a little bit more service and would give me a chance to kind of upload into that a little bit more.
So I find myself wondering if Mark was a small house person.
He wasn't. He and his wife and kids lived on a big farm, and he was a really good carpenter. And very insightful, and he was a triathlete. So, no, he wasn't a small house person, but he and his wife and their friends, who've now become my friends, definitely had a spin on what it means to be a part of a community. And, you know, it looks like volunteering at the overflow shelter and having a garden full of good organic food and sharing that food and, you know, kind of linking into your community in a different way than I had time to do in the past. So, you know, part of living in an 84-square-foot house is that you suddenly, you know, have a little more time and money to do the stuff that really engages you and really inspires you.
Yeah, tell me about this. So you had a nice 3-bedroom house. Do you mind talking about the finances here? What kind of bills were you able to chuck and in exchange for living in 84 square feet?
Well, my mortgage at the time was about $1,200 a month, which, you know, isn't that bad, actually. And I always had housemates to help me carry that. And then, you know, utilities were probably in the wintertime another couple $100 on top of that. And then there was insurance and, you know, the yadda-da-yadda-da-yadda-da that goes with owning a house, including, you know, the heater goes out, you got to pay for that. Or an endless litany of home repair projects. And so living in a smaller house, I get to live rent-free. My friends whose yard I live in the back, I barter out with them. I'm kind of the fix-it person. So I mow the grass and clean the gutters and remodel their bathroom and do stuff like that. And I help caretake the woman who is next door. So I get to shower at her house. So essentially, I went from, you know, probably at least $1,500 a month in expenses for a home to about a $5 a month utility bill, which is the propane that I use to heat the house and cook.
So I wonder if you could take me for a virtual tour of your home. Here I am standing in front of it. What do I see, and what would happen if I walked through the front door?
Well, my little house looks like a little cabin. So it's got a pointy little roof. It's corrugated metal like you see in most of the third world. And it's cedar clad. I got this really just beautiful old growth cedar from a neighbor of mine in Portland that he had originally purchased this cedar in like the 1940s and had it stored up in the attic of his garage all those years. So this cedar on the outside is just stunning. It's really beautiful, beautiful cedar. And a door that's a very small door. It's like 2 feet wide. I pulled that out of a dumpster and it's gorgeous. And a little front porch, and there's a sleeping loft above the front porch, so that kind of creates this little nook of the front porch. So you take a couple of steps up onto the porch and walk inside after you take your shoes off. And if you go to the left or turn to the left, there's the kitchen counter. And I have a crock that I carry water into the house, and there's a sink that drains into a jug under it. And if you turn to the right, there's a toilet and where I keep all my boo-boo dust, you know, like my towel and my toothbrush
boo-boo
and stuff like that.
Dust? Boo-boo dust?
Boo-boo dust. Yeah, in the Pacific Northwest, those are cosmetics.
Oh, excuse me.
For people like me, anyway. So you take a couple of steps, and you're out from underneath the sleeping loft, and you're standing in this what I call the great room. It's about a 6 by 6 foot space and has an 11 foot ceiling with a big skylight, and that's my living room. And I have a drop down desk in that area. That's where I work if I get to work at home. On reports and stuff like that. And there's a ladder that I move out of the way that I can drag down, and I would make you crawl up into the sleeping loft to try it out because it's incredibly spacious even though you can't stand up there. And there's another skylight that's over the bed, which is just an incredible gift. I mean, there's nothing like being able to fall asleep staring at the stars or the moon or watching it rain over and over and over again for days on end.
So I've seen pictures of your house. It's very small, but it's very cute. I think somebody might call it adorable. And as I understand it, you got your plans from a company known as the Tumbleweed Tiny House Company.
That's right, yeah.
So what were these plans, and what did you do with them?
Well, I think I was one of the first people to buy a set of plans, and before I bought the plans, I kind of tracked the owner of the company, Jay Schaefer. I tracked him down, and as it turned out, he lived about a mile from my brother in Iowa City. So, you know, being wise and being in the Pacific Northwest, I asked my brother to stalk him and track him down and take a look at his house, and Jay was very accommodating, and then I flew back to visit my brother and his wife and kids, and while back, I got a chance to meet Jay and try on his house and see what it looked like and felt like, and I fell in love with it. So I bought a set of plans, and the plans were essentially like an 11 by 17 inch piece of paper, and I kind of retooled it because I wanted to have this, you know, great room, this clear story, and I wanted skylights, and I wanted, you know, I kind of fit the house to meet my needs, which were pretty basic, and Jay had a lot more storage, and he's an artist, so he needed a lot more space for his supplies than I did.
How big was his house? How big is his house?
His footprint was the same as mine. At the time, he just had, like, the sleeping loft went across the entire length of the house. And he had a big giant wood stove because it gets cold in Iowa City. And he had a shower in his house, and I don't have a shower in mine. So, those are the kind of the differences that I redrew, and I kind of re-engineered it a little bit so it would tie into the trailer a little bit differently too.
Talk to me about exactly how you built this. You have obviously some building skills yourself. You have some carpentry skills. As I understand it, you got some cedar, some shingles from a friend who stored them long ago. But where did you get your other stuff?
Oh, I scavenged a lot of stuff out of debris piles. So on the outside of the house, a lot of the wood, like the roof of the porch, the overhangs, the soffits, all of that is salvaged. The skylights came from a salvage yard. And when you walk inside, it's like the kitchen counter is an old pocket door. The wood that's on the walls, it's knotty pine. That came from like a habitat restore. And the loft flooring came out of a house fire. It's like the house kind of grew out of what was made available over a certain amount of time as I was gathering materials for building. And, you know, that it's kind of cool to be able to live in a space that, you know, tells a story like that. It tells more of a story than I went to Home Depot and I got a great price on this. You know, it's like I get to say, you know, this sink was in the crawl space of my big house left behind by one of the previous occupants. And look at it now. It's a perfectly good, beautiful ceramic sink. Or, you know, I get to say that my shelving over the kitchen that I hang my coffee cups on and put my plates on, you know, that's copper tubing left over from when I replumbed the house, my big house in Portland. And the silverware is stuff out of the old silverware drawers that I had in Portland that I bent into coffee hooks, coffee cup hooks. So it's kind of cool to live in a space that says more than, you know, financially I got a great deal on this. Although a lot of the stuff that I got from like the Rebuilding Center or Habitat Restore was a lot cheaper than I would have gotten if I'd bought it new.
As I was coming over to this interview, somebody said, the 84 square feet now, does she add in her sleeping loft to that square footage, or is it just the footprint of the bottom of the house that's 84
square feet? It's just the footprint of the bottom. Yeah, it's just the footprint of the bottom. And, you know, I guess the rule of thumb for architects is that if you can't stand up in a space, you don't have to count it, or you just don't count it. So I think if I was to pull a real estate ad, it would be one bedroom, bonus room, with a bonus room. And I don't even know that it would be like a quarter bath or something like that, because I just have a toilet and I don't have a sink.
Okay, now wait a second. You said you haul your water, but you have a toilet, so...
I have a composting toilet, and, you know, so I've got these new chores that are a part of living in an 84-square-foot house. And so managing my compost is one of them. Dragging water into the house for washing dishes and stuff like that is another chore. I still haven't completely figured out I have solar electric panels, and I'm, you know, off the grid that way. And, you know, people have asked me, like, how does that work? And I'm like, I don't know. It's like somehow electricity is gathered and it runs down this black cord into the battery, and then it goes through an inverter and it powers things. But, you know, as far as the mystery of a solar electric system goes, I still don't completely understand it.
What do you ask the solar electric to do? I'm wondering about a refrigerator, which uses a lot of power.
I don't have a refrigerator. I have a cooler. I actually, when I built the kitchen counter, I measured wrong. And the refrigerator, you know, went to shove the refrigerator in under the counter and it didn't fit. And it's like a problem with my carpentry skills. There were several discoveries there. But so I ended up sending the refrigerator back and was using a cooler, and I just got into the habit of, you know, kind of continuing down that path. And I really like it, actually. It's pretty simple. I buy fresh produce almost every day. So the food co-op is only a few blocks away. And I put popsicles and ice cream in my neighbor's freezer, so I don't really need a freezer.
Uh-huh. I was wondering if maybe there was a lake you went and did some ice cutting or something in the winter and had a little ice house out back.
Well, you know, this year in the Pacific Northwest is the first year I remember that, you know, we actually could have done some stuff like that, you know. So, no, there's no nearby lake.
So, but you do have a friend's freezer.
I do have a friend's freezer.
And you have a friend's shower.
Yep.
And you have a friend's yard to park this thing.
Yeah, and, you know, kind of setting up that relationship, you know, essentially there are three households that live on this property. It's a big, you know, double lot in the city. And my friends Hugh and Annie and their kids live in one house. And they were my link to the backyard. And I approached them actually before I finished building my house and kind of checked in with them to see if they would be willing to let me land in their backyard for a while. And they were very accommodating and lovely. And, you know, of course, they wanted me to move into the backyard. And next door to them is Hugh's Aunt Rita, and she's 84. And so she kind of occupies that second household. And I didn't know her very well at all before I moved into the backyard. And, you know, now she is, I adore her. She's great to live with. She's disabled. She had a stroke several years ago. And I shop for her. I help her, you know, fix things in her house. I cook sometimes for her. And in return, she lets me take showers. I get water from her tap. She keeps me company. She's hilarious. She was in the CIA in the 40s. And I know. She's just got great stories. And then she also hangs out with my dog during the day when I'm at work. So my dog has kind of gotten fatter and fatter over the years and very happy.
Now, your arrangement isn't necessarily so permanent, is it? I mean, you have it on wheels, so you can actually move it around if you need to or want to. How often do you?
Right. You know, I pull the house out like three or four times a year, but mostly for like Earth Day event type things. And or, you know, I've taken it up to the grade school and had the entire grade school pour through the house at different times during the day. And so, no, I love the backyard. It's funny because it's totally worked on me. And I think, you know, some of the lessons that have been really good for me are kind of trying to figure out how to deal with being 45 years old now and still living in somebody's backyard, you know, and learning how to ask for things was and still is a challenge. You know, it's like culturally we're really programmed to be pretty independent, and the only time we would ask for help is if we were in dire straits of some sort. And somehow there's a huge pride tied to being able to kind of manage your life alone or only with your kind of nuclear family. So it's been a really good lesson for me to learn how to accept people's gifts, and my friends have been wonderful at teaching me that. And, you know, the end result is that, you know, I end up kind of having a lot more space in my time and with my money and inside me in the way that I approach the world. I think that gives me a chance to kind of pull out you know, kind of how I want to be in the world and what's my intention and how can I serve my community in a different way.
Okay, Dee, you live in 84 square feet of living space, and you don't have much storage there. So how does one scale down from a three-bedroom house to something that is, you know, 12 by 7, essentially?
I had to do it the hard way. I had to go through everything. I had like three piles when I was in Portland. That's where I built the little house, and that's where my bungalow used to be. You know, three piles. One pile was the stuff that was definitely going to get dragged out to the curb, and it was massive. It was like, you know, the moldy old ice cube trays and saggy futons and, you know, linens and garden tools and, you know, just this never-ending, you know, litany stack of stuff that makes up a household. And I got rid of all of that stuff. And it was pretty easy to drag that stuff out to the curb other than, you know, this questioning like, oh, am I going to wish that I kept that, you know, garden hose later? Am I going to want that 20-foot ladder later. And I haven't had that come up with any of the stuff that I got rid of. I haven't wondered, you know, gosh, you know, I wish I still had all of those empty flower pots. Those were great. I wish I still had all of that silverware that didn't match that I've been dragging around since college. That stuff was great. So that hasn't really come up. And then I had a couple of pieces of furniture that were kind of special that I gave to friends and asked to hold for me. And kind of suggested that if I didn't come back to get it in a couple of years, then they could have it.
So, you sort of got rid of it, but you kept a few strings on it, huh?
Oh, yeah. The strings are there. And, you know, I have visitation rights. So I can still go visit that beautiful oak dresser my parents gave me as a wedding gift. And whenever I want. I haven't really wanted to, though.
Okay. So, threw stuff out, gave some stuff away, kind of, and then?
And then, you know, I was left with the stuff that was just overwhelming to try to figure out. Like, this is the stack of, you know, the old love letters, you know, the old, like, trophies of, you know, different things from your past. And then also, you know, stuff that, you know, gifts, the stuff that reminded me of other people, that, you know, my nieces and nephews, my mom and dad, friends over the years. And, you know, those are your, you know, these just beautiful, beautiful candy dishes that you end up with, these knickknacks, you know. And so I put those in, I think I started out with four of those, you know, those plastic kind of bins. I ended up with about four of those, and then I moved with those, and then over the years, I've gotten it down to about a fourth of one. That's the, you know, I've got like a photo album, and gosh, I can't even think of, old VHS tapes from different things that have happened in the past. So that's my little memento box.
You got rid of the love letters, though.
I got rid of them. Yeah, I'm glad I did. That way, you know, I'm safe. Nobody will know.
The ones that you wrote or the ones you got?
The ones I got. I think it's better to let it go. Move on. You know, it's like that whole, you know, that's the kind of stuff you pull out like as you're moving. You know, you forgot that you even had it up in the attic. And, you know, you pull it out and you get this great couple of hours kind of down memory lane. And, you know, I think it was time for me to let go.
Okay, but what about going forward, Dee? I mean, every day there's stuff that we encounter that comes to us or that we think we need to have. What do you do with that?
Well, I kind of have this revolving door. So if I bring something in, I try to get rid of something. So if I get a new, you know, jacket, I'll pilfer through and see if I can find something to get rid of. I'm down to, like, two forks. I started out with seven, I think, and so the forks are easy to let go of. So I've acquired a new pair of shoes and got rid of a fork, or, you know, kind of continue to rotate my possessions. If I get a new pair of pants, then I'll get rid of an old pair of pants. And, you know, it's kind of a cool thing to have this mindfulness around that. You know, I don't have any place to store stuff, so it actually is kind of liberating to kind of feel like I don't necessarily need to acquire more. I've gotten really good about asking to borrow stuff too. So recently I had a big kind of award event that I got to go to. So I borrowed a beautiful dress, and you know, it really is nice to be able to have friends that have things. If you lived in town, I'd borrow something from you.
Okay. So you must have an inventory then of everything. How long is your list? How many things do you have?
I have 300 things, and I only have a list because I got into this competitive, you know, naming thing with this guy in Portland, and he was convinced that he had fewer things than me. He was wrong. Actually, he did have fewer things than me, but so we sat at this coffee shop and ended up listing everything that we owned, and you know, including, you know, shoes, car, house, everything. And I came up with 300. And, you know, it's interesting to look at that list because it's, you know, shocking to discover that, you know, as a woman in today's world, I've called my eyeglasses jewelry. Or, you know, there's this whole question of whether or not it's appropriate to call my house without, would I categorize that as like just one thing, or do I have to count everything inside of it? And, well, of course you do. So.
Uh-huh. So you have, let's see, I have a shirt that I'm wearing. It's got buttons on it, and got a belt and trousers, ordinary, you know, pair of socks and everything. So what happens if one of these buttons comes off my shirt?
Oh, well, this is, it's funny, because I had this conversation the other day. It's like I had counted this button that fell off a sweater as one of my items because I hadn't gotten around to sewing it on yet. So, you know, this friend of mine in Portland and I got into this whole thing of how do you count? Do you count, you know, each chopstick is one? Do you count, like, if you can sew something onto something else, do you have to count it? And then he got into this whole thing of wanting to, like, clip his gloves to his coat. You know, he would just get a series of clips, and that way, you know, he would essentially have one clothing item and everything else would just be gravy.
Uh-huh. So, Dee, I got to say, you must be, well, let me put this gently, you must be really challenging to shop for around the holidays.
You know, I've been lucky because, number one, most of my friends don't have any money anymore, so holiday gifts are experiential.
Oh, so you're
it's like, come over for dinner. So as far as gift giving goes, I have been lucky because, like Rita, the older woman that lives in the house in front of me, she gives me these coupons for, like, taking a tub soak, which is awesome. There's this place in downtown Olympia you can go down and do a half-hour tub soak. And so she gives me gift certificates for that, or I'll get gift certificates to come to dinner or go to a movie. Or Hugh and Annie gave me a gift certificate for the Film Society. They bought me a membership. And so actually, you know, the gifts actually work out great. And I've gotten into the habit, you know, it's worked the other way too. I don't buy stuff for people really anymore. My thing is more to offer to come over and help them build a chicken coop, or offer to come over and help them, you know, do gardening for a day, or try to make dinner for them. I say try because making dinner is sometimes challenging.
And how do you count dinner? I mean, is a head of lettuce one item? Is the pomegranate another? Is the
I don't think you have to count perishables, Steve. You don't count the perishables. Come on.
Food doesn't count. Okay. So, by the way, just for editing purposes, so who are Hugh and Annie?
Hugh O'Neill and Annie McManus, and their kids Kiva and Kellen, and it's Rita Harrigan.
And so they're the people where you have your house parked.
Yeah, they own the property where I have my house parked.
And who was Mark?
Mark Bentley. He was a dear friend from, I met him at work, and his wife Shelley and sons Brett and Kai. And, you know, it's interesting because I didn't know them very well at all before Mark got sick. And during the 14 months that he got sicker and sicker, I got to know him and got to know his family. And more than that, I got to know this just expansive community in Olympia that was willing to kind of rotate, you know, cooking, cleaning, chores for this farm, all sorts of things that they offered Mark and Shelley. And, you know, how lucky am I that I got to participate in that? Because I learned a huge amount about myself by being able to kind of be in that caregiving role.
What kind of reactions do you get from people when you tell them about your house?
I don't talk about it.
You
kidding.
Don't.
You know, at first, when I first moved to Olympia, I would get a little uncomfortable when people would ask where I was living because I'd lived in Olympia years before. And, you know, I'd run into old friends and they're like, so where are you staying? I'm like, oh, I'm living in Hugh and Annie's backyard. And, you know, there was this moment of just like, huh. And we get this kind of silent look and then, you know, they'd move on. So that was a little bit challenging. And, you know, that's kind of a part of the cool thing about living alternatively anytime you do is that it's not so much dealing with other people's reaction to it, but what it brings up for you, you know. So all of a sudden I was in a position to really examine what was good for me and to act that out and be really confident about it. And so at first, you know, when my family found out I was building a house the size of an area rug to live in, they were very nervous for me and thought that I would regret, you know, selling my big house and all of my, you know, the money that I had built up and all my equity that I had built up in that house. And now they love it. They get it. They really would love to be able to have, I think, as much time and disposable income as I do. So, they, you know, I think they get that.
So at what point do you think you might decide you don't want to live in this small space anymore? Or maybe decide that you want to downsize even further?
Well, I think, you know, I have thought about downsizing further only because there's a lot of wasted space as far as heating goes. You know, it's like the smaller your house, the easier it is to heat, the more, you know, it kind of looking at my carbon footprint, trying to take a look at minimizing the house is the easiest thing for me because I certainly don't want to give up coffee or beer or bananas and the carbon footprint tied to those things or traveling. So, you know, as far as downsizing goes, yeah, I've thought about that. And then more recently, I've thought that's foolish. I'll go nuts. I need at least 84 square feet plus a bonus room. And then as far as, you know, moving on to something else, I think if I, you know, fell in love and decided I wanted to be with somebody over a longer period of time than a few nights, I would definitely need more space. And I would like to think that I could take the stuff that I've learned in this giant experiment in the backyard and apply that to whatever living situation I have. So, you know, we'll see what happens into the future, but hopefully I've learned kind of how to live inside a smaller footprint, and that isn't necessarily indicative of a tiny house, but maybe a tiny lifestyle.
So let's say that you do, in fact, decide that you want to take up housekeeping with somebody who mm-hmm. becomes a partner for you, a life for at least a season, if not necessarily mm-hmm. for a lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
What will be the most important things for you to negotiate right away?
Oh, how to get along.
In terms of the space, of course.
Yeah. Well, after kind of getting over the fact that, you know, I've lived alone for 4.5 years and I'm a creature of habit and, you know, things go a certain place, which I think would be really interesting to kind of navigate with another person, because if you've ever... You know, it's like I'm a bachelor. You know, I mean, I've done this thing alone for a long time, so I think just being willing to share space with another person would be a little bit of a challenge.
Besides, if you leave the cap off the toothpaste, that becomes two items.
That's right, and we got to keep an eye on the numbers. I think I'd be curious to see how I would deal with somebody else's sense of possessions. You know, so I am certain that every single one of my 300 items is perfect, and somebody else's items would be silly. So there might be some negotiating around somebody else. You know, like I have this small window elf, this little felted elf that a friend of mine's daughter made. It sits on the window, and, you know, that's not silly. But somebody else's small felted elf would be silly. So there would definitely be, I don't know, I think it would be really interesting and really, I think, just awesome to have an opportunity to see what does come up around, you know, not so much the limit on how many things you have, but why you have them. You know, is that really something that brings you joy? Is it something that you find beautiful? Does it have a function? And what about it is something that you want to caretake, that you want to pay for, that you want to clean, that you want to keep in your life as a distraction from other things that you can be doing or, you know, working on.
And now for Okota. So you were motivated by seeing the poverty of Guatemala. How do you feel about abundance now?
Oh, I think, you know, abundance is something you walk around with when you walk down the street. So... it has nothing to do with the count of possessions or the amount of change you have in your pocket. It's just a different value system, you know. There, I think it was Mahatma Gandhi came up with this list of 7 social sins, and you know, there are all of these things that we wrap around as far as a definition of who we are in the world. Things that define us, like our religion, our income, our politics, you know, that sort of our education. You know, those are all the ways that we typically define ourselves. And then we present that by the size of the house that we live in, or the kind of car that we drive, or the type of clothes that we wear. And, you know, for me, I think I've really tried to take a look at what I have inside, which is kind of a deeper humanity and a deeper sense of morality and a sense of discipline and action. And, you know, that carries itself out more in a, trying to live a greater sense, with a greater sense of service to, you know, the earth and to the its many, many different inhabitants. And you know, I can't see spending a lot of money on clothes or a huge house when there's this gaping hole in the universe. That's this this world that needs attention. So I guess that's the abundance that I'm looking at in my own life, is this real intent heart. And I feel really blessed that I'm surrounded by people and I live in a little tiny house that gives me a chance to explore that, you know. And that doesn't mean I get it right. There's still a lot of room for improvement as far as, you know, what comes up for me. But I feel pretty lucky that I have a life that gives me a chance to do that.
Dee Williams, how happy are you?
I'm pretty happy. I feel pretty blessed. You know, I'm very fortunate, and it just keeps getting better is the thing that's been surprising for me. You know, so when I first moved to the backyard and discovered I was in early retirement, you know, I was able to quit my job and work part time, and you know, all of a sudden I had more time. I definitely had, you know, more income, you know, for the layout that I had, more money to offer to others. And I thought that was pretty cool, but it's like the little house and living in the backyard has opened up this new kind of origami of experience for me. It's like I see my world with such a different eye now. And I feel so blessed to be able to live inside a city and have, you know, scrub jays and squirrels and raccoons, the vicious raccoons of Olympia, around me. And I live in the Pacific Northwest, which is just stunning, and I feel like I get to absorb that differently because I'm not as frenetic in my life. And then I've also just gotten to see how stunning my human community is too, you know, very generous with me and very, very graceful. And that seems to open up a heck of a lot more room for me to respond to my world with maybe a little bit more compassion. So that's pretty cool. That's hot stuff right there.
Dee Williams lives in Olympia, Washington. Well, at least that's when her tiny home is parked there. Thanks so much, Dee.
Thanks, Steve. I really appreciated an opportunity to talk to you.
All right. Well, the pleasure was mine. And Bobby's.
So when you edit this, will you make me sound really smart?
No way. Well, we don't have to... You don't have to make you sound smart. You sound smart already.
Well, thank you for that generous compliment. Make me sound wise, then. How about insightful?
An insight is another object.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so you wouldn't want to have another.
You know, it's funny because I was working on this list, trying to articulate the list and what made the list and what didn't make the list as far as possessions go. And, you know, I didn't list my dog, of course, because, you know, why would you do that? You know, my dog is her own self, you know, and I didn't list a lot of other things that define, you know, a sense of home, like, you know, being safe and secure and loved and a sense of belonging. But, you know, those are all shoved in that little house with me. So it's I really appreciate an opportunity to answer the questions that you've offered, because it really helps me explore what that story is all about for myself. So thank you so much.
My pleasure. All right. Thank you. Thank you, Tacoma.